thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument in Bland Independent School District versus Blue.
May it please the court, Mr. Jim Harris, to present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is going to be 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, at issue in this case is how should a trial court determine if a taxpayer has standing to sue a public entity for an allegedly illegal expenditure. There are two interrelated sub-issues. The first is, can extrinsic evidence be considered in making that determination? And the second is, what conditions must exist for the taxpayer to have standing? The answer to the first question should be yes. This court and seven courts of appeals have implicitly recognized this answer. The only court that says it is error to consider extrinsic evidence, that is, evidence outside of pleadings and decided to plead the jurisdiction, is the Dallas Court of Appeals. Now, why has that court reached a result so different from seven other courts in this court, at least implicitly? And I think it stems from a failure to distinguish between three very different types of pleas to the jurisdiction that can be filed. The first type is a plea in which the claim is that a jurisdictional fact is missing from the petition. It's just not there. The second type of plea to the jurisdiction is where you challenge jurisdictional facts, but those jurisdictional facts are interrelated with the merits. The third type of plea to the jurisdiction is where you are simply challenging jurisdictional facts as opposed to jurisdictional facts that are interrelated with the merits. Now, in the first type of the plea to the jurisdiction, you don't need extrinsic evidence. The pleadings will determine up or down whether jurisdiction exists. The second type of plea to the jurisdiction, you don't want to hear extrinsic evidence. The difficulty there is that the extrinsic evidence will actually be a trial on the merits. And that's inconsistent with the theory of dilatory pleadings, which is to delay or defeat a claim on some basis other than the merits. And the courts that have written about not considering amount of controversy fall within this second category. Challenging jurisdiction based on the amount of controversy is a jurisdictional claim that's intertwined with the merits and therefore essentially requires that the entire case be heard before you can make a determination on the plea of the jurisdiction. In that situation, it's simply not appropriate to hear evidence in that particular situation. This rule, the second type of plea, also puts some boundary on pleas to the jurisdiction. Otherwise, at a practical level, what will happen is that you can start concocting situations where every claim in a petition is somehow jurisdictional. There is an exception, however, to this second type of plea to the jurisdiction, and it exists where someone falsely alleges facts to confer jurisdiction. In that situation, even if the merits are intertwined, the court will hear extrinsic evidence based on that particular allegation. And I would share with you that this sort of rule exists at the federal level and has been followed fairly consistently and with some success. Now, the third type of a plea to the jurisdiction where you're disputing jurisdictional facts, you both need and want extrinsic evidence. You need the extrinsic evidence to resolve the dispute, and you want it to save judicial resources. If you are able to determine whether the court has jurisdiction at an early stage of the proceeding, then you avoid the time and expense of having to go through summary judgment or full-blown trial on the merits. And I think the legislature has recognized this fact when in 1993 they allowed interlocutory or accelerated appeals in situations where a plea to the jurisdiction filed by a governmental entity has been denied. Again, recognizing that those sorts of disputes should be heard early on in order to get those matters off the docket and not expose the public fisc to having to go through a trial when the court doesn't have jurisdiction of those sorts of claims. Now, allowing extrinsic evidence on pleas to the jurisdiction where the jurisdictional facts are disputed is not a novel approach. Receipt of evidence in all other dilatory pleadings, other than special exceptions, which are a special case, have long been recognized by all courts in the state. Special appearances are a dilatory plea. Motions to transfer are a dilatory plea. Motions to quash improper service of process are a dilatory plea. Pleas in abatement are a dilatory plea. In all of those dilatory pleas, there is no question in the jurisprudence of this state that extrinsic evidence, that is evidence outside of the pleadings, can be considered and has long been considered. There is no reason to treat pleas for the jurisdiction, which are just another type of dilatory plea, any differently, as long as you recognize the three categories you're talking about and that where the jurisdictional facts are intertwined with the merits, you do have a special situation that requires special treatment.
In this particular case, of course, the trial court did hear the evidence and did decide against you.
Correct.
And are we in a situation where we have to say, as a matter of law, the trial court was wrong in deciding against you in light of all the evidence?
Yes. The trial court accepted the evidence. The Dallas Court of Appeals said he shouldn't have considered that evidence, but when you bring that evidence back in, then standing does not exist here, and let me explain why. It really goes to what type of plea did we file in this case? We filed the third type of plea where we were disputing the jurisdictional facts. We didn't implicate the merits. The merits in this case are, did the school district follow the proper procedure in getting the money to build the high school? And we haven't raised or touched on that issue in the plea of the jurisdiction. What we do dispute is plaintiff's view of their jurisdictional facts. And to understand why those facts are disputed requires an answer to the second question that I posed, and that is, what elements have to exist for a taxpayer to have standing? Now, the answer to that question under established standing doctrine should be never. In Texas, the courts have consistently talked about standing in the context of when you sue a public entity for violating the law, essentially trying to enforce a public right, as requiring that there be some special or peculiar or distinct injury. And that just doesn't exist in the case of a taxpayer. The taxpayer shares that burden with all other taxpayers and doesn't have anything peculiar or distinct or special. And at the federal level, that understanding is well recognized. I can't go in and bring a lawsuit challenging an expenditure by the executive branch as being illegal. I just don't have standing at the federal level. And that would be consistent with the traditional Texas doctrine, but Texas early on also, and I might add that the theory really behind that seems to make some sense, is that a single private party should not be the appropriate representative for the public interest. What you're generally talking about are institutional decisions, and yet you are appointing somebody as a private attorney general to represent the public interest, even though they've not been elected or appointed or otherwise clothed in any institution.
Who is the appropriate prosecutor for some action like this?
The Attorney General's Office, the District Attorney's Office, quo warranto proceedings are an example in situations where an entity acts ultra vires and individual realtors can come in and ask DA or the Attorney General prosecute such an action in order to protect the public interest. I would add, though, in response to that concern, Justice Abbott, that Texas recognized that in certain limited situations, taxpayers can bring an action. It was established a while ago. I'm not sure it still is necessary today, but it's there. The dispute here is over its elements. It does exist, and the dispute here is about its elements. Now, what do the Blues say? The Blues essentially say that any school district taxpayer can challenge any future school district expenditure claimed to be illegal for reasons other than reasonableness. So any school district taxpayer can challenge any future school district expenditure claimed to be illegal for reasons other than reasonableness. We don't read the case law that way. In our view, the elements are that you can have any school district taxpayer can challenge a school district expenditure that involves that taxpayer's money where the expenditure is claimed to be illegal for reasons other than reasonableness, and the relief requested in effect does not require the return of money spent or does not require that a benefit already conferred on the public be given up.